You are now listening to a podcast made in collaboration with the Copenhagen College Radio.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in to episode 75 of the Social Media and Politics Podcast, bringing you expert insights into how social media is changing the political game. I'm your host, Michael Becetta, political scientist at the University of Copenhagen. Connect with the show on Twitter at SMNP Podcast and sign up for the newsletter on our website, socialmediaandpolitics.org. All right, y'all. Thanks so much for tuning in. Here we are at episode 75 of the podcast, and we're going to cover something in this episode that we haven't covered before, and that is human rights. And my guest today is Ray Serrato. He is a social media analyst at the United Nations Commission on Human Rights, or OHCHR. And Ray has done a lot of work using social media data to, for example, monitor elections, study misinformation, hate speech, and vulnerable communities in contexts such as Germany, Myanmar, Pakistan, and Sri Lanka. And Ray's research has been featured in outlets such as the New York Times, The Guardian, and CNN. So excited to have him on the show. And what we're going to talk about is Ray's work in the context of working with human rights for the UN and what kind of tools he's using, what kind of data he's looking at, and what that data is used for, whether that's corroborating evidence of a human rights violation or monitoring for sort of early warning signals of violations going on. We get a bit techie with that in the first third of the interview, so you computational social scientists out there will enjoy it. And then for the remainder of the interview, we're going to hone in on Ray's work in Myanmar and the persecution of the Rohingya people. So if you've been following the news, you've probably heard something about genocide and Myanmar and Facebook. And that was really a point of controversy that kind of added on to the Cambridge Analytica scandal and the kind of PR crisis that these platforms are facing. So I had read about it as well, but didn't know so much about the context. So we're going to lay out what's the political context in Myanmar, what's the tech platform situation there, and what exactly happened in this case. And so it was interesting for me to get a deep dive into actually what was going on in Myanmar. Ray has been monitoring the case closely for years and pulled some Facebook data, and we're going to find out what he found. And just as an aside, we recorded this just a few days before the Christchurch mosque massacre in New Zealand. But I think there's a couple parallels that can be drawn, also thinking about our episode with Dr. Alice Marwick on far-right extremism. So even though the Myanmar case and the New Zealand case are years apart, I think this interview is really timely, and maybe there's some parallels to be drawn there. So without further ado, let me bring on Ray Serrato. He is a social media analyst at the United Nations Commission on Human Rights. Ray, thanks so much for taking the time out, and welcome to the Social Media and Politics podcast.
Thanks a lot, Michael. It's great to be here.
So let's start off by talking a little bit about your background in digital. How did you get involved with social media analysis, and what brought you to the UN Human Rights Office?
Right. So I have a kind of interesting background that before I began working at the UN and in the NGO field, I was actually in the military for around 6 years. And I trained there as a telecommunications expert and specialist, and also working on radar and a bit more like hardware focused. Mm-hmm. But that was around 2 years of training. I did 6 years of working in that field. And then after the military, I got back out and I went to university, studied political science. And then I joined an NGO in Berlin, which was working on election observation in Tunisia, Pakistan, Sri Lanka, Myanmar, Ukraine. And, I originally kind of approached social media from the perspective of elections. So I think maybe right after the 2016 elections, we were also interested in understanding what social media can tell you about the quality of an election and whether or not, you know, the same standards which are used in election observation, which usually refer to like the international obligations, which, you know, states have ratified, which relate to, you know, the right to stand for elections, universal suffrage, things like that, whether or not they could be applied in the observation of social media. So if we're looking at, for example, how are candidates campaigning online? Are they allowed to campaign online? What kind of abuse do women candidates in particular or vulnerable, so-called vulnerable groups face online? So it was a lot about, I think that was the initial perspective. And I began that research first by learning programming languages. So, you know, I didn't have any kind of formal training in programming languages, but I picked up R around 2 years ago. And I used that kind of as the first project was to look at the elections in Germany. That was in 2017. So from there, the rest was kind of history in a way. So then I started to look at other things that I was interested in. I was working on Myanmar since 2014. So I looked at, of course, what happened in Myanmar. More recently, I looked at what's happened in Germany in far-right protests. And, you know, I saw a very interesting role at the UN where they were looking for a social media analyst, specifically in an investigative role. And, you know, I applied for it and here I am.
And how exactly is the UN using social media data? Like, how is it approaching it and what is it kind of looking for?
So, I mean, it was actually quite new for me because I had approached the whole idea of using social media data to tell us something about elections and the quality of an election. And this role was a lot about using social media in the context of human rights. So using content to identify and verify human rights violations, humanitarian violations, or even possible war crimes or crimes against humanity. So in practice, that has meant kind of collecting information from social media, trying to determine like provenance and authenticity, and generally analyzing any patterns in that content, which is usually always, you know, video, images, or text.
Mm. And are you kind of starting from the top level and kind of seeing like what's going on, for example, Twitter, and then zooming in on a certain thing that might flag a human rights violation? Or are you using some type of intel to kind of narrow down into specific conversations and see what's going on?
Right. So I have colleagues who work kind of in early warning and prevention, and I think they're really looking at the macro level. They're looking for specific keywords that are appearing in certain regions or in kind of countries they cover. Since I'm working on a very specific cases, the starting point has usually always been much more sharp and focused. So, for example, looking for content that I know was posted during a specific period of time and location, or after having identified reliable sources, you know, that are in those locations, collecting information from their posts, and then corroborating it with other data points.
Gotcha. And what other types of data are you using? I mean, there's the social media data, but I mean, are you using, I don't know, public opinion polls? Are you using satellite data? What other types of data are you working with?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So definitely we use other types of data. So most UN investigations, they have a standard of evidence and a proof called reasonable grounds to believe, which requires that, you know, violations can only be confirmed if they are corroborated. So corroboration must occur kind of through several independent sources, one of which is the victim, can be the victim, or through a pattern of events or another body of information that shows a violation occurred. So maybe as a practical example, if we received information from a third party, say an NGO or something, that pertained to an unlawful killing of an individual. If possible, we would use images, video, or other evidence that we retrieve from social media to determine the identity of the individual. So is it actually the person that they say it is in the submission we've received?
Mm.
You know, time and location. So if they say this person was killed at this time and location, do we have images or videos which can actually confirm, you know, if it was time and location? And then, of course, even identification of perpetrators. You know, they say this particular individual or group is responsible. And we usually, for every kind of claim that we receive in a piece of evidence, we usually try to corroborate it with social media data. And sometimes that can be quite difficult, right? Especially because if you think of, say, for example, metadata, which is, it's all been stripped out of social media data. So we have to rely kind of looking at upload times, which isn't necessarily the most reliable piece of information, but it gives us a general idea of when it took place. And then we have to look at the image itself and then try other geolocation techniques to verify, you know, the time of day, to identify any pieces of evidence in the content that can tell us about the time of day. So, for example, someone might be attending to a victim and wearing a watch, which then has a timestamp on it. And then, of course, you have live streams, which I think those are really more powerful pieces of evidence because we have the time at which it was streamed and uploaded. And that's kind of the case, I think, particularly when you have things like Periscope videos and Facebook videos, where then we have, you know, the actual live stream of the event as it occurred. And we just have to kind of extrapolate. We have to, you know, convert from UTC time to whatever local time that we're reviewing.
Right. So let me ask you, I think it's interesting that, you know, the social media data is kind of part of a larger operation to identify these human rights violations. How are you approaching different platforms like Facebook, Twitter, YouTube? I mean, do they have different utilities for this type of research?
Right. So, I mean, the tools I use, for example, are all open source. I work in R, which I guess you're probably familiar with as well.
Definitely.
I have to actually give a big shout out to you know, people who create a lot of the packages. So like RTweet I use, which is, I think, created by Michael Kearney at the Missouri School of Journalism. Then I use Tuber to access, and RTweet, of course, is to access Twitter's API. RTuber is for, you know, the YouTube API. Until, you know, Facebook closed its Groups and Pages API, I used rFacebook. Now I use a different technique. And then for Instagram, I've used a kind of Python scraper. So particularly once I've identified, you know, an account or images which we want to grab, we use a Python scraper to kind of download all of the, you know, either all of the accounts, images, or videos, or stories. And then there's also the ability to kind of create a file with metadata. And in addition to those more more technical tools, I also use kind of Facebook graph searches and Instagram graph searches. So as an example, if I'm trying to determine the affiliation of an individual, we can use Facebook graph searches to try to find, you know, what's their comment history, what's the photos they've been tagged in, what's the, you know, places they've checked in, what are photos they uploaded, where they've been visiting, things like that. I mean, the Facebook graph search matrix is really quite powerful.
And do they have certain purposes? Because I'm thinking, you know, different countries, especially developing countries, might have different rates of social media adoption. So is it just whatever is the most popular platform of the country, or is it that maybe streaming on Facebook might be a more common way of getting killings out or something? I mean, do certain platforms have those specifics in terms of human rights violations?
No, that's actually a really good question. So like in some cases, I might not use Twitter at all because it's just not. It's not being used in the country. I think Facebook is really the dominant platform, especially, you know, outside of the West, where you find a lot more videos uploaded to Facebook, either to live or just, you know, on Facebook. And then sometimes on YouTube. So it is really country dependent. And I think that's always the first thing to think is that I approach, you know, to use in terms of approach. I mean, sure, you have, you know, sources which might keep, you might submit, you know, information confidentially or publicly. And then you have just kind of the general overview of, like, you know, collecting. So an example, in one investigation, I was collecting YouTube videos basically every 2 weeks and then having to collect them based on certain keywords on which I would know videos that were being uploaded would have, you know violations or referring to violations, or if they were referencing certain locations where violations occurred.
And how do you actually, I mean, I'm thinking a lot of these videos and this content will get reported to the platforms themselves. And obviously there's an interest from the platform side to crack down on this type of behavior. You know, Facebook's recently upped its content removal team in response to disinformation, for example. So how do you try to get ahead of those violations or ahead of the platforms removing that content? Because I'd imagine that they're kind of trying to remove it very quickly. So how can the data kind of show those type of violations?
That's actually a really, really good question. And it's incredibly difficult, I have to say, you know, for investigative work, because, you know, I think sometimes we'll find a piece of evidence and maybe we didn't archive it in time. And then it's gone. It's been wiped, you know. So that's actually incredible. You know, I think that's something that's been something that we learned as well, is like archive information specifically from, you know, Facebook or YouTube, which is useful immediately. And then you have the other, you know, I think the other rather problematic aspect of all this is that, you know, you might have states which are committing the violations, right? They might be, you know, the military of a government, which also requests platforms to remove content before, you know, we have the ability to archive it. And there's not sufficient country-level data released by the platforms to kind of know the nature of those legal requests that they receive from states. So I think Facebook's Transparency Center, for example, has, I think, the number of legal requests they receive to remove content, but the nature of those, you know, they're not available to third parties. So I think that's actually a big challenge for us, because you have states which are attempting to, you know, delete content, which is problematic for them.
Right. Because it might, I guess, be bad PR if it gets out.
Well, not only that, it could also be used as evidence in terms of prosecution.
Interesting. All right. I want to jump into Myanmar in a second, but I have one more question along these lines, which is, you know, we know that political campaigns have been working with representatives at these companies to better optimize their targeting strategies and, you know, learn how to use the platforms better. I would imagine that especially because of all this kind of heat on the platforms around disinformation and, you know, live streaming violence, that there would be an interest from their end to work with the UN and different institutions in order to remove this content. So do you have a working relationship with these platforms or you know, kind of strategy in terms of how to identify these violations?
Well, definitely. I know the office has a relationship with the platforms, with most of the major platforms. But I would say in my investigations, we didn't have a need to reach out to them specifically. And I think the Myanmar case is quite illustrative in one respect, because the fact-finding mission to Myanmar was also in touch with Facebook about attempting to retrieve data, particularly, I think, from the senior general's page, which he had deleted. And as far as I recall, Facebook's response was that they couldn't retrieve that data. And you know, pass it over to the fact-finding mission.
So let's dive into this Myanmar case, because it's been really a kind of prime example or something that's really been in the media recently, even though it was being flagged, you know, I think as early as 2014, maybe even earlier. Before we jump into kind of your research and what you found there, why don't we set the stage a bit and talk about the context in Myanmar? I mean, it has interesting history, but, you know, what was the political context around the Rohingya people there?
That's actually a really good place to start, because I think, you know, I think we'll get into it a bit later. But, you know, I think first it's really kind of important to state at the outset that Myanmar's history has really been dominated by the military, which is known in Myanmar as the Tet Mada. And they've ruled the country for most of its existence, you know, even after the election of Aung San Suu Kyi and the National League for Democracy in 2015. The government is basically a quasi-civilian. A large portion of its administrative apparatus is essentially controlled by the military. The 2008 constitution was designed by the military so that they would maintain power, both politically and administratively. And you know, members of the military, they occupy around 25% of the seats in the parliament, and they are appointed by the military. And the, you know, Aung San Suu Kyi is not, unlike elsewhere, she does not have any control over the armed forces in Myanmar. So that's the background in terms of the military's role in Myanmar. But you know, it's also home to kind of numerous ethnic groups with varying cultural and religious backgrounds, linguistic backgrounds as well. The largest group is the Bamar. They make up about 70% of the total population, and they're predominantly Buddhist. And then you have many other ethnic groups which live near the borders with Bangladesh, China, Thailand, and India. And before Myanmar had gained independence, there was kind of a framework that recognized the identities of all kind of the ethnic groups and gave them some autonomy, but it was never really realized. And since independence, the military has kind of used ethnic conflicts to justify its role in politics. And it also kind of created or defined major ethnic groups and about 135 so-called national races, which have zero scientific basis, and which also almost singularly excluded the Rohingya, despite, you know, their having lived in Myanmar for generations. So that's kind of the background in terms of the Rohingya. And I think since around 2011, there's been kind of a huge increase in anti-Muslim rhetoric and violence between Buddhist nationalists and Muslims. And there's been a lot of tropes around the Muslim population and illegal immigration, although the Muslim population is around 4% in Myanmar. But this narrative has been used to great effect by Buddhist nationalists. And one group in particular, the Association for the Protection of Race and Religion, which is also known as Mabata, that was established in 2013, I would say is one of the leading persecutors of the Rohingya in Myanmar. And they were primarily, I mean, they're a Buddhist organization, and they also developed widespread grassroots support because they also took over a lot of social services. The most prominent leader, I think, has been profiled even in time, is called Ashin Rathu.
And so there's this group, the Rohingya, that's a Muslim minority in the country. And I want to ask about the kind of technical context as well, because it's interesting. I mean, Myanmar, obviously a developing country where Facebook is the internet there, right? We've heard a lot about Facebook being a provider of internet services in order to get new users onto its platform. And Myanmar is one of those cases, right?
Yeah, it is. It's you know, I think last year there was a stat that, you know, 80% of online traffic actually is through Facebook, which is quite astounding. I mean, the president, the state counselor, the commander-in-chief until his Facebook account was shut down, the interior ministry, and many governmental institutions actually rely on Facebook to release news and information. I mean, media outlets as well, they have, you know, millions and millions of followers, and they use Facebook as the main way to disseminate articles. I mean, it's really true that it is the main, if probably not the only platform for online news in the country. But this is also in a context where there's very, very low rates of digital and social media literacy. And you know, then, I mean, coupled with this, you have the perception that Facebook is really a reliable source of information.
So what exactly did you do then in terms of researching this? I mean, was it something that you heard about and then looked into, or were you monitoring it actively? Kind of what was your starting point into researching this?
I mean, so since I've been working on Myanmar since 2014 or so in the context of the elections, I was always aware, you know, of what was happening outside of the election, you know, the political and the social context. And in 2017, in August, the Rakhine Rohingya Salvation Army, which was also an insurgent group, they staged and coordinated around 30 attacks on government security posts in Rakhine State. And this was kind of the triggering point for the violence that came afterwards. I mean, it triggered essentially a massive military response. But alongside, you know, this militarist campaign, you know, against ARSA, which was really indiscriminate and targeting, you know, the Rohingya community at large, I saw that online there were a number of journalists that I had followed in Myanmar that I was familiar with, who were then being attacked and harassed on Twitter primarily. And I found this very curious because most of the messages that they were receiving seemed to be from kind of, you know, trolls, or we think of trolls, but they were all rather similar. And they were referring to the attacks by ARSA as being conducted by Bengali terrorists. Bengali is a derogatory term used to refer to Rohingya in Myanmar. And, you know, I thought it was really a new phenomenon to see this on Twitter. So my initial research was actually looking at kind of these explosion of Twitter accounts, which had popped up. It was around 3,600 or so. So immediately after the attacks by ARSA, I would say by the next morning, you had this huge number of new Twitter accounts, which were basically blaming the Rohingya at large for perpetrating the attacks against the police. They were attaching a lot of photos. There were also the narratives that the Rohingya had begun to burn their own homes in order to frame the military. And there were attacks also maybe 2 days later. It was the 25th, by the 27th and the 28th, there were also attacks even against the UN as an institution that, you know, they didn't care about the rights of ethnic Rakhine and other ethnic groups like Hindu, which were allegedly also targeted by ARSA. So that was the first start, you know, the first time you saw, I mean, Buddhist nationalists existed on Facebook since 2011 or so, 2012, 13. But you had never seen them cross over onto Twitter. So it was kind of the first time that I saw kind of international, or, you know, a coordinated attempt to influence international perceptions of what was occurring.
Is that why, I wanted to ask you, because you've just been talking about Facebook as the dominant platform. So what do you think is the reason that this explosion kind of happened on Twitter?
I think it really was that there was an attempt to kind of influence the international perception of what was occurring, of what would come, I would say, you know, because you had the ARSA attacks, which triggered the military's indiscriminate response. And I think it was really an attempt to kind of frame what was going to come, which was the military was going to continue these so-called clearance operations in Rakhine State that would drive the Rohingya out, you know, at large. It wasn't a focused kind of attack on this insurgent group, but rather against the entire minority group. And I think it was an attempt to kind of, you know, set the stage for that.
Right. So you have this kind of framing to set up for the press. And then what happens in Myanmar? And then where does Facebook come into the picture?
Right. So after Twitter, I mean, I knew that Facebook was kind of, you know, the platform to look at. And I switched quickly from looking at Twitter to looking at what was happening in Facebook. I mean, I was curious to see, you know, what's happening there as well. And I think the first place of where to start, I mean, for me was, of course, to look at Facebook groups in Myanmar. So you have some groups which had, you know, almost like a million members. At that point, Ashwin Rathu, who was this prominent leader of Mabata, he still had a Facebook account. And he was, you know, using it to spread a lot of hate during that time as well. And since you couldn't really scrape any posts from private accounts and the API was still open, I thought it'd be interesting to look at pages and Facebook groups. So the group's API was still available then. And I identified several groups that Ashwin Rathu was actually a part of. And I started to kind of you know, retrieve data from those. So, and one of those groups was actually called a platform for Mabata supporters. And at that time, it had around 55,000 members in it, and it kind of called itself a hangout for Buddhist patriots. And so I started to, to retrieve data there and, just look at a temporal analysis. So what does it look like? What do posts look like over time? What kind of posts are they sharing? Are they images? Are they videos? Who is sharing these posts in these groups? And in that specific group, I found that between August and the 1st of November, there were like overall around 15,000 posts, but almost 90% of them, or around 13,000, were posted between August and November. And they had basically really shot up after these attacks by ARSA. So, the attacks by ARSA were used as an opportunity to also vilify Rohingya just overall.
And we're there because my understanding of it, or at least what I've read, the very kind of top line short bit is that, Facebook was used to encourage, basically incite violence against the Rohingya. Is that what happened? Were there like calls to action to go out and kill? Because that's kind of what I've kind of seen just looking at the general media reporting about it.
Yeah, I mean, for example, in this particular group that I looked at, there was definitely an organized campaign to incite hatred against Rohingya, especially during the Haile crisis and the following months. And there were, there were posts which warned about overpopulation by Muslims, about, illegal immigration and comparing Muslims to animals, essentially, so dehumanization. And there were also images which were quite gruesome of injuries and dead bodies. And they were quite widespread afterward. It's really unclear. It was unclear to me then if anyone who reported the post or the group to Facebook. And that group was only shut down in 2018. Huh. But even outside of that, that specific group where you would generally expect to find this kind of content. You had groups, for example, there was a large group on Rakhine State, with around 400,000 members, which also would have posts which were rather casual, now the military has cleared all the Bengalis out of Mongdal, and celebrating, the expulsion of the Rohingya. I think there were a lot of posts that outside of, explicit calls for violence, were also calls to dehumanize the Rohingya and to portray it also as what they called an operation against terrorists. But, the terrorists in this case were always Rohingya.
I think the platforms would say, if we look at the Russian disinformation case and the Senate hearings that happened in 2017, for example, the Twitter representative there was quick to point out, when legislators were asking, how much disinformation is on the platform. Twitter is quick to point out, and Facebook is as well, that I think it was for Twitter, 8 times more users were coming out and saying that this is fake. And so that community element, where was that in Myanmar? Because I would imagine that these kind of violent pictures would be reported to Facebook because so many people are on the platform. Or do you think that the digital literacy is so low that people just didn't think to do that?
I think digital literacy is quite low. I mean, that's definitely the case. But there was also a normalization of these views. And I think that's something, that is in some of the media reporting that's occurred, In your question, I find another question, which is like, I think there's a question of whether or not Facebook kind of played a role. And I would not personally lay something like genocide at the doorstep of Facebook. I mean, especially in this context, because like the Rohingya faced systematic abuse, usually at the hands of the military, for like 2 decades, and they've been persecuted for their based on their religious beliefs. So like in 1978, 1992, they fled to Bangladesh in the hundreds of thousands, and this was all before Facebook ever existed. But that being said, like the emergence of Facebook and its dominance as like a mode of public communication definitely changed something. I mean, so hate speech and misinformation, it took on a lot greater potency, specifically after these attacks by ARSA. I think the fact-finding mission in Myanmar also had like, I think they even identified around 150 different social media accounts and pages and groups that were contributing to hate speech against Muslims in general, Rohingya in particular. And, I think when you think about the scale of that, like 150 different pages, not to think of the number of followers they had, but I think some had over 10,000 and some even over 1 million. And the levels of engagement on those posts, it's a monumental task for, people who disagree with those public sentiments, of which there are unfortunately not very many in Myanmar, to flag that kind of content to Facebook. I think that was, I think the sheer scale of the content was not something that, ordinary people could grapple with. And I think obviously Facebook couldn't either as well.
And I mean, I guess the sheer scale of, you know, the spike in activity that you find, I mean, that basically just hints at coordinated activity, that this was planned probably in tandem with those ARSA attacks.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, when I looked, for example, there was around 1,600 accounts which were posting messages to the group, but only around 3% of the members produced the majority of the content. In fact, there were around, I would say, 10 members who were contributing to the group, sending as many as 300 posts each month. And I mean, at that time, it wasn't clear to me the provenance of those accounts. And when I met also with like a few civil society groups in Myanmar and showed them the data and we talked about it and went over the content, some of them, there was a lot of speculation, like, who is it behind this? Is it China? Is it Russia? You know, like, what's going on here? Or is it just like, you know, I think is others would call it like strategic narratives, which are kind of collaborative work of an online community or something. But there were also whispers that it was the military back then, but we had no way to kind of verify that information or, you know, and of course, I think now more than a year after that, Facebook made a statement that, you know, that it was the military that was coordinating disinformation alongside its operations in physical space.
So what, if anything, has Facebook done to address this? Because obviously this case has become somewhat of a focal point in the media. Have they taken steps to put content moderators there? Kind of what has the platform response been?
I think that was the largest criticism a lot that they received also was, right, is that they had no physical operations in the country. They had no Burmese-speaking moderators. And you saw that they were essentially trying to hire a group of Burmese-speaking moderators for the country specifically. I don't know the exact numbers of those. I know that they began hiring, I believe, early last summer. I know that they were hiring first a community manager and then also content moderators. But and then, they also said that they were stepping up their efforts to use AI to identify a lot of the content. I mean, which is quite difficult because in Myanmar, there are two kind of fonts which are used online. And maybe as a different kind of obstacle is that many of the posts that we looked at were image macros, you know, which are kind of beyond the reach of AI for now. But, you know, they would have image macros, which would, for example, show dogs eating in a kennel. And then they would have alongside that images of allegedly Rohingya also eating food somewhere. And so, you know, these kind of things are much more nuanced and I think beyond the reach of artificial intelligence. But I mean, that seems to be the route that Facebook is taking in Myanmar and I think elsewhere. And I think that's not one which unfortunately can work at scale, although they want it to.
Right. Well, I'd like to end with a question that I'm curious about, which is along these lines, and it has to do with your kind of approach to particularly these open source tools and the kind of data streams that are closing down. There's really nothing that, you know, also from a research side that we can do if these data streams are cut down. But I mean, how are you thinking about that going forward?
Yeah, I think that's really all I would say. First, I know for the impact on you know, scientific research would be, I think, terrible. But I think also for this kind of work, it would also be just as bad. So an example is from Facebook is, you know, since the closure of the API, it's been really difficult to kind of look at groups and pages which might be reducing problematic content and, you know, using that to help us identify where violations might be occurring. And there are even some limitations to the platform which exist even now and never existed outside the API. So, for example, looking for videos on Facebook, that's never been possible via the API. And I think even the actual searching for videos on the front end is just really quite terrible.
Right.
I think the only solutions we have in mind is really, I think, what I know one academic has called the post-API age, moving over to scraping. But that's going to be another, I think, a whole different ballgame, I think, in terms of, you know, the skill sets that we have to acquire. With limited resources, even, you know, in this particular area, we're using open source tools. It will be a tough thing to overcome.
Well, I think we're all in the same boat, and I'm sure there's some listeners out there who are as well. So, Ray, thanks so much for taking the time out. It's been great.
Thanks a lot, Michael.
I've just been speaking with Ray Serrato, social media analyst at the United Nations Commission on Human Rights. And And that's a wrap for this episode of the Social Media and Politics Podcast. Thank you again for tuning in. Next time, I'll be speaking with Bill Ottman, CEO and founder of the crypto social network Minds.com. And we're going to look at the role of cryptocurrencies and blockchain in social networks. Subscribe to make sure you get that directly into your feed. And until then, I'm your host, Michael Becetta, signing off from Copenhagen. See you next time.